This is the Knowledge Bandits Podcast, and I'm your host, Arum Galadima. Let's start the show. This is the Knowledge Bandits Podcast, and I'm excited to bring you today's guest, Mr. Juda Baga. Juda Baga, better known as MI, is an award-winning Nigerian musician, and he's also the founder of Loopy Records. He's won Best Hip Hop Artist and Best New Act at the 2009 MTV Africa Music Awards, and he was nominated for the Best International Act category at the BET Awards in 2010. MI, I've really glossed over, your entire catalog, but can you take the time to let the bandits get to know you a little bit better?
Yeah, man. My name is MI. Juda Baga, as you said. I'm from Nigeria, beautiful part of Nigeria called Jos, a city in sort of the middle part of Nigeria. And I love making music. I've loved the opportunity to make music. For people that haven't heard any of my music, you can find most of it on, whatever platform. But I make sort of rap music with a lot of infusion of African sounds. And I've recorded 7 projects out there, 3 mixtapes, which are less like mixtapes than projects that I gave out for free. I really put a lot of work into them. And I hope that sort of covers everyone who's hearing about me for the first time.
Nice. So just a few things. When did you get into music?
I was always passionate about music from when I was like super young, and I think some things in life or some people in life, you just have always known what it was you wanted to do. But it took me a while to, walk into the realization that I would be able to do it as a job. So it was always just something I thought I'd do for fun, and I think there's a process that you go through where your hobbies, you get validated enough in your hobbies to say, hey, maybe I could make some money doing this. As far back as I can remember, I've always loved music. I remember being 6-7 years old and just being fascinated about, chord theory and like how the keys were arranged and how, every note, how you could transfer from one note to another note and play the same music just in a higher key and, sort of the math behind it. It's not that I understand it at a high level, but just conceptually as a child, it would always blow my mind, how amazing music is.
And what instruments do you play?
So being a recording artist sort of allows you to cheat and sort of diminishes, that skill set if you're not playing live all the time. But I play keyboards, I play bass, I play drums. I wouldn't call myself like a professional by any stretch of the imagination. I can get around and sort of figure out what to do. But I think with most people that are playing like instruments, it's more about the theory behind music. And when you can figure out the theory, then you can sort of apply it to different instruments if you just practice, hard enough.
Yeah. And I definitely asked that question because going to Calvin, you would hear rumors of MI rapping, but the little known fact was that MI was pretty, pretty dope on the keys as well.
Yeah. This is true. Yeah. Yeah. I did everything. So Calvin was such a great time for me because I was in a gospel choir. We had this group called African Acapella. I was also sort of like the DJ for parties. We would have unofficial parties at people's houses. So, I tell everyone I've been a manager, I've been a dancer, I've been a DJ, I've been a producer, I've been an engineer. Like I've done the whole nine in music.
Yeah. And so what is the importance, you'll say, in terms of the success that you've seen, what is the importance of having all of those pieces?
So as far as understanding how to play an instrument, right, I think it's more important now to understand how music works than it is to play an instrument. Because if you understand how music works, you can put together music now, presently, without understanding how to play an instrument. It's not to say that people shouldn't still learn music and stuff, but it's just that some of the greatest like writers now and composers aren't trained you know, to play instruments. They just understand how music works. So to me, that's the most important thing. But it will, however, help, because the process of learning anything, right, it's education itself. So in just learning keyboard, you're going to see chord progressions that you couldn't have come up with yourself. And they will inspire you by just, you know, learning that. And also, I mean, having discipline in anything is also, you know, so the discipline, I mean, I never had the opportunity to go to school for piano or whatever. But in just learning, I knew I had to put in hours and try. I remember when I started learning how to play guitar in Calvin, and it was so hard because my fingers just don't, you know, really fit the neck of a guitar. And so just all the time I put in and tried to songwrite at the same time. And I sort of wrote, you know, created my own little way. It's not very good, but my own little way to play guitar. And it's just a discipline, you know. It taught me so much that I use when I'm in the studio now. When I go through moments where I have writer's block or whatever, I just know I could just, you know, buckle in and keep working.
Yeah. And I'm wondering, is your family musically inclined? Are your parents musicians? Were their parents musicians? How did the whole music thing come about?
So, I mean, for most Nigerians, I would say, maybe Africans, we're not so far removed from, you know, generationally from being in a village at some point. And you know, most of the village setting is about music and oral, very oral, musical culture. So people are singing, people are dancing in community. So music isn't far from, you know, I don't think my parents would have seen themselves as, or my grandparents would have seen themselves as musicians, but they were very musical, as most people were, right? Urbanization sort of does away with that, sort of, you know, divides us into, you know, these are the musicians over here. But my mom is actually a singer, and she's put out a couple of gospel albums. And my dad just loved music. Like, he would be playing music. He'd play Bob Dylan. He'd play a lot of gospel music, Andrew Crouch, a lot of that stuff. And it would just, I'd just wake up and just see him, you know, whether he's ironing or cleaning or whatever, he'd just be listening to these songs and singing along. And I think that's where the love for the power of music has in people's lives came from.
Now, so, I mean, making music is one thing, but I think for Nigerian parents and possibly African parents just all across the continent, rap music would probably not be their first choice for their kid to go into. So, I mean, did you face any pushback from your parents and family members when you decided that you were going to take a career in hip hop seriously?
For my parents, I don't think, you know, they were able to, the line to hip hop isn't as clear as in, if you say I was in the States where I say, hey, I want to be a hip hop artist. It means something different from saying I want to be a musician. I think for them, it was just, you know, I wanted to be a musician, but they'd known, like, and so you remember I said I'd been a producer, I'd been a manager. So, and early on, I said I didn't know that I would be able to make music for a living, right? So I was always around music, but I was always doing something else, always contributing in some other way. And so I think they've sort of seen me be functional and responsible around music, as opposed to like, hey, I'm in the studio all the time recording music. And I think that sort of, you know, gave them a little bit of comfort in knowing that, hey, our son is pretty responsible and, you know, he's hardworking and he sort of figured it out. Also, there was sort of like a boom happening in Jos at the time where there's a lot of energy around young people in music. And of course, my mom too recorded music. So, there's never any pushback. They supported, they have up till today. And, you know, I think that's one of the best things, you know, about having them as my parents.
So, a lot of people might not know, but Jesse Jags is your brother. I mean, when you look at the combination of you two, I think some of the greatest music you've made is when he's producing that stuff for you. I mean, his beats are, I mean, phenomenal. Did you guys plan on getting into this together, or was he also just sort of musically inclined on his own and you guys met later on?
So, I mean, when we were going to church, we were a part of a small congregation called Plateau Church. My dad was a pastor. And it wasn't very musical, you know, at the time. It was a lot of songs, a lot of hymns. But then the church started buying instruments. And, you know, the first few times I would see drums and keyboards where when our church bought them, and we would sort of figure out at home, you know, little songs, how to play little songs. And then after church on Sunday, you know, practice, if we got like 5 minutes or 10 minutes, just play around on the drums, right? But eventually what ended up happening is that because I was so interested in music, Jesse would come along and then he'd be like, oh, let me sit on the drums while I was trying to figure out keyboard. Because I felt drums are sort of, you know, in terms of theory, you know, they're you probably require more technique, but the theory to play drums is easier to, you know, to grasp. But keyboard was like a lot more interesting to me. And so Jesse, and come to find out Jesse is this naturally talented drummer. I think what happens is that when you start to get validated early on, it's something that you love to do. And here he is, super young, and he's, you know, drumming for the church. Sometimes when the actual drummer isn't around, what happens is that, and you start to just, you know, daydream and how far can I take this? And both Jesse and I at different times on different journeys, we're having sort of the same journey as regards dance, as regards music, as regards, and I guess it helped him. Maybe you can ask him, but, it helped him to have an older brother that he could, you know, compete with, right? Yeah. But by the time I got back from Calvin, Jesse was like a full, like, rap star. I had no idea that he was rap. I had no idea that he was into dance, but he was like this full rap star, you know, and he was killing it. He was the man in Joss, actually. In fact, my first time on stage in Joss, I was introduced saying, this is Jesse Jack's brother. yeah, it was super funny back then. But I mean, somehow we just found ourselves doing the same thing. And when we started the studio, a studio called Inner Hub in Joss with a guy called Bola BBC, we both started working together, and him and I would have conversations about, hey, let's do this music thing together as brothers and see how far it goes. We had no idea. I mean, we never saw any of this, like any of where we are right now.
Hmm. And when did Ice Prince join the mix?
Yeah. So one day we set up in the studio in Joss. We're sort of doing work, and we're set up in an area called Lamingo in Joss, right?
My village.
Yeah, hey. So one day Ice Prince just shows up and just says, hey, I want to battle MI. And I'm like, oh, really? yeah, I heard he was about that. So I proceeded, and this is fact. You can Wikipedia it. Not really, but it should be fact. I proceeded to destroy him lyrically. And I remember when I was done, he said, oh, I think it's a draw. And it was hilarious. This young guy that just came. Over the next few months, we got to know him, and he was always helpful around. And, you know, say, hey, I want to be down with what you guys are doing. Eventually, one day we had a very deep conversation where he had lost his dad a couple of years before we met. And he said, hey, you know, I'm struggling in school, but I really love this music thing and I really need guidance. And, you know, I want you to look out for me and sort of be like your older brother. And from that conversation, I was just like, I just said, okay, hey, I'm going to look out for you and whatever I'm doing. And I mean, who could have known that, you know, this African superstar would emerge from, you know?
Yeah. And definitely jumping around a little bit, when did you start Loopy Records?
So Loopy started as an idea in Joss with just, you know, right before I met Ice Prince, just a bunch of friends that were, you know, and we were basically the guys that were around the studio and crew that around the Inner Hub circle. But it was a bunch of guys. I actually just wanted to be the manager. I wanted to just be, you know, I was working at the time. I had a little bit of money. I was like, hey, I'll pay for studio sessions. You guys record. We'll become the number one crew in Joss, right? But what happened was that the first few sessions, no one showed up. And when they did show up, they weren't very serious. And so I said, okay, I'm going to record. And then I recorded one thing, and it ended up becoming something that people liked. And then I recorded another thing. And all of a sudden, you know, people are like, oh, Jesse's brother isn't that bad, you know? And took off that way. But it was a bunch of friends. I had a few classmates that, you know, one was into graphics, one was producer. And I said, hey, let's do this together. Over time, it became more serious. And we sort of streamlined the crew to people that joined later. So Ice Prince joined later. Lindsay, Eve joined later. But Ruby, Jesse, and I were there from like the initial, you know, crew.
Mm. And at what point did you guys sort of merge with Chocolate City, and when did you come about meeting Audu? What can you take us through that period of time?
Yeah, so I met Audu through a friend of mine who I've always known since we were kids, like Jeremiah Grant, who was sort of the first big Joss star. And you know, okay, P Square was sort of doing their thing, but here comes Jeremiah, gospel artist. He has this huge song, huge record around the country. Everyone is playing it, everyone is talking about it. And and at the time in Joss, I was sort of like a PA, I would say, PA manager. I was helping him, you know, book events in Joss and stuff like that. And what ended up happening was that one day he got signed. He told me, oh, this label from Abuja coming to sign me. And I met with one of the guys, Paul. And Paul told me, yeah, we're the ones trying to sign Jeremiah. And so Paul and Aldo started this thing called GAP, Guild of Artists and Poets. So I was connected to Paul through GAP. Jeremiah had met Aldo somewhere else, I don't know. But when they had met, Jeremiah had said, you know, this is the guy, I'd spoken to Paul about it. Paul said, yeah, that's me and Aldo that are doing together. And so, through Jeremiah, I said, meeting Audu, and then we'd go for events together. And one day I recorded the song, I played it for Paul, and Paul then played it for Audu. Paul actually pretended to be cool. He was like, yeah, it's all right. But he says that in his mind, he was like, yo, I just heard the best, the best record. And he called Audu and told Audu. And, eventually Audu called me to, you know, I went to Abuja. He sat down in his apartment. He told me, he said, hey, let's freestyle battle. If I win, you sign. If you win, you don't have to sign. And I didn't take the offer. I would like to think now that it's because I knew I was going to destroy him. But actually, there's something so super confident about how he said it. I was like, huh. You know, he already has bars ready. Then over the next like few years, I was part of the Chocolate City family. They knew about Loopy. And I told them, hey, Loopy is my scene. So when I started, you know, doing well in Lagos, I started Loopy in Lagos, you know, as a corporate entity. You know, registered it, brought Ruby to Lagos. By the time Jesse and Ice was already signed to Chocolate City. So, but eventually, when Audu wanted me to become the CEO of Chocolate City Music, then he said, you know, hey, you know, we can't do, you can't compete against the company here. Can't own one company and then be, you know, the CEO of another. And so I said, you know what, make me an offer. And they did. And we are here today.
Wow. I mean, I think you did a really good job just sort of glossing over all of these things, but I'll definitely unpack a little bit of what you were talking about. So one of the things that's always on my mind is that artists are really an interesting category of people, because like while they're professional musicians, they're also businesses in and of themselves. They have to present themselves in a certain way, and they have to brand themselves. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because that's something that young musicians might overlook completely, but talk more about the business of branding yourself as a musician and then the business of music.
So, I mean, you know, with music, there's so much uncertainty and so much, you know, doubt and so much, you know, just faith in maybe I'm correct and maybe I'm wrong. And, you know, you're always second guessing yourself because there's always a standard at a time that the industry is going to, you know, look to. And it'll seem like people that are replicating that are being successful. At the same time, there will be your authentic self, which you're fighting to sort of save and keep. At the same time, there'll be the best version of this authentic self. So I'll give an example. Let's say a fella, you know, used to just hang out. And so the question is, you look at those pictures and ask, you know, obviously the photographer that took those pictures, you know, was a very good photographer because of the lighting, the way he's positioned, poses are iconic, you know. So in some way, that's the authentic fella, but was it packaged? Were there like 10, you know, was it shot 10 times and then, hey, or was it just natural? Was he just caught in the moment, right? And so somewhere within this mix, as an artist, you have to find what your brand is and what you want to stand for. And at the same time, leave space to keep evolving because artists changing. People are improving, you know, sound is improving, samples are getting better. People are going to want to listen to new things. So it really is something that I don't think that was designed by God or whatever people believe in. I don't think people were designed as much to be successful at as the journey in trying, the attempt. You know, every artist will tell you that for one level of success, there are people that are going to be disappointed and telling them, hey, you sold out, or I don't like the way you could have done this better, right? And it's sort of just finding the place where, you know, you're okay to be at the time, but also the perfect place to allow you to pivot if you need to. And it's just a weird, crazy mix. What I will say is that the best way I found is to surround yourself with people that really love you and really care and really willing to go hard for you, and listen and sort of, you know, have some principles for trusting people and then just going with that, because you're never going to be right, you know, and you're also never going to be wrong, you know. There's always just going to be the journey. There's always going to be the work that you need to do in front of you. But, I mean, there's no, like, piece of advice that any artist has given me or that I've read that, you know, sort of is one fits all. It's just be yourself at the same time, be better at the same time, be ready to change at the same time, remember who you are at the same time, be willing to experiment. You know, it's like, it really is, you know, a crazy, crazy, crazy
thing. Yeah.
It's almost a terrible life in some ways, especially when you get super successful, because you almost never know who you should be. I don't know if I'm saying that correctly. But one thing that's worked for me is to be able to separate clearly who I am as an artist and who I am as a person. And so as a person, then I can just have stability. I can have people around me that know me for who I am and not because I'm an artist, right? And I can have stability there. I can have steady growth there. So whatever happens in the music world is just like having a bad day at work. And I can take that off at the door and come into my house and just be a human being. But at the same time, sort of having that approach will allow you to be sort of a moderate artist, whereas you have people that will be completely sold out to their art and create amazing product, amazing music that way also. So I think Jesse and I are sort of on both sides. I'm more of like, you know, I go to work, I do my job, I come back home, I'm just chewed. You know, Jesse Jags is super about the art. You know, he's super, he is completely committed. And again, as I'm saying, no one is wrong, no one is right. You know, they're both just, you know, choices that we make and that will come with certain amount of sacrifice for each one.
And to stay along this theme of the business of music, artists, I'm sure it's changed quite a bit since you first started, but how did you monetize your music early on versus currently?
It's a great question, man. So basically, what happened for Nigerian music was that we started out knowing that we're going to deal with piracy, we're going to probably not be able to monetize. So where the world is sort of now, we began 20 years ago in Nigeria, knowing that, you know, hey, music is selling music in itself, in and of itself, is not going to provide money for you. Mm. So we had to find other ways to make money, to do shows, to be brand ambassadors, to, social media, get a huge following, and sort of develop this model that the world is, you know, turning to now. Let me not go off on a tangent. Actually, let me finish answering this question. So we developed this model, and what it is now is a rudimentary way to explain to people to say, think of your music as your business card, right? You're going to spend some money on a business card, but by and large, you want to give it out to as many people as possible and let them have it with the least amount of, you know, cost to them. You know, just meet somewhere, hey, here's my business card, so that by the time we've met and you have my business card, when you need me for something, you know how to get to me. And we sort of, you know, allow music. We are okay with music being distributed as close to free as possible, right? People still want to monetize. People still put their music on iTunes and on Spotify, on Deezer, on MTN Music Plus, etc. But for the most part, what the artist wants in Nigeria is for their song to be everywhere. When it's everywhere, then all of a sudden, hey, we want to do a gig. We want this artist to come. We want to do this. We need this artist to do that. And that was sort of the model. And I figured it out early on. And so my first single that did very well, what I would do is I'd go to do performances. I would tell people to switch on their phones and I'd just give it out for free. And all of a sudden that song was everywhere. And then, everything else sort of took off from there.
Interesting. And, you know, just hearing you talk about that, it's an instance where I think African artists probably innovated that space before American artists, because now you see people distributing music for free on SoundCloud, some of the largest musicians in the US, but that wasn't the case before. It was always something held tight and people had to pay for. And I mean, I think it's just important to note that fact, just because it's important to realize that Africans are innovating industry as well. I mean, you look at M-Pesa and the finance industry. Now you look at the way the music industry works. Really, Africa has been a leader in pushing that sort of model forward.
You're absolutely correct. And I just got back from Nairobi. So the M-Pesa story is like, I was seeing people live it there. And people saying, hey, I just paid my rent with M-Pesa, or, stuff like that. Necessity, you say necessity is the mother of invention, right?
Yeah.
And necessity in Africa, it really is driving innovation. And we wish for a time when, we have governments that support Nigerians to be innovative, that support Africans to be innovative. Because you're correct, so much innovation had to happen for MI to be here, for Audrey to be here, for Jesse Jack to be here, for Two-Face, Wizkid, Davido. We had to, figure out, how to... I mean, to the States now, you hardly see people working in big studios, right? You come to Nigeria, producers are working off their laptops, right? And studios, we never had to know, have big studios, have big, and that's what you see with the SoundCloud generation, right? We had not just OK.com, which were really distribution for music at the time. Everyone that's online and Twitter and whatever. So African artists have been ahead of the curve in terms of understanding what social media will do for artists, understanding what people having access to the music will do. If we have some sort of support system that allows musicians to thrive, it will do so much more for our industry.
Interesting. And I mean, you mentioned Wizkid, and my mind immediately went to Fast Money, Fast Cars. I've heard stories about how that song came about and how Wizkid ended up on it, but I'd like to hear from you what is the true story about that.
So there's a lady called Osage. She's a super manager in Nigeria, and she's always been about networking. Like, even as soon as social media came about, they would do events. And so there's this one event that they had called Sundays at the Bay, and it was at a beach. It's just a bunch of young people would go alcohol, with suya, go hang out. And so I get close to Osage doing these events and hanging out with her and her crew, and she would manage artists at the time. And she had this one kid, you know, called Wizkid, you know, who she's kept talking about, oh, he's so talented, you know, and I've met him a few times. My music starts taking off. He comes, he's like, you know, sort of that younger brother space. And we talk about music. I'd listen to his music. One day he comes and he's like, oh, you know, hey, I don't know if, you'd be open to signing. And at the time I had Jesse and Ice Prince. And so I had seen it with Ice Prince. There's something you see when you look at certain young people. But I didn't know how we would find space on the label when we already had Jesse and Ice Prince. Mm-hmm. You know? So I said, bro, hey, you know what? I'll sort of see. Whatever else I could do, I can help with. But I just want you to know that if you sign today, it's going to be me. It's going to be me, then Jesse, then Ice Prince. In terms of this, I don't think that's the best scenario for you because you look ready to go. And he did. I mean, he had an album ready. He had music ready. He was just a phenomenal, you know, phenomenally driven young man. So fast forward a couple weeks, maybe a couple months. I'm finishing up my album. I'm literally almost done. And I'm talking to this producer called Kraft. And Kraft sends me, Kraft's like, hey, you know, we haven't done anything on this album. You know, Kraft used to produce for Mode 9 a lot, and he was, you know, popular in the hip-hop scene. So he said, you haven't produced anything for me. I say, you haven't produced anything with me. I say, hey, send me a couple beats. He sends me this one beat, you know, doesn't have the bed of music on it. It's just fast money, fast car, fast, and the drums. And so I play these chords over it, and Wiz comes over. Listen, I'm about to leave the house. It's like, I'm leaving in 10 minutes or whatever. Wiz comes over. I'm like, hey, let me play this beat for you. I'm going to give it to you. Take it home. If you can record something with it, when you're ready, let me know to come back. He says, let me listen to it. I play for him. Immediately, he starts singing, if you don't got money, I'm not sure. I'm like, yo, that's dope. You record that? He's like, yeah. He records it. I'm like, yeah, you know what would be dope? If you could add a little bit of, like, you know, a bar or something to it. As I'm saying the words, he's like, I'm like, oh. Wow. I record that. Now, this must be said, at the time, Wizkid was only making like reggae music. And so even me asking him to do like, he was making like Pato Ranking type music, right? So even me asking him to do Yoruba music at the time, I'm thinking, hey, he'd need some time to go, you know, record. He does the hook, put it on my album, I record my bits, put it on the album. I'm not thinking, you know, comes out, it's like literally, you know, in some way, I feel like it's a claim of fame. Like, even when we say, like, oh, M.I. was part of Wizkid, like, I feel like I was just lucky to, you know, I've been in the room with this amazing artist before everyone else, you know, and have that be part of my story, you know, because you've gone on to see, like, this guy's taking on the world.
Yeah.
And in the same way, I worked with him recently, and it's the same thing. He'll hear a beat, and the music will just flow out. And there's a few people I've seen be able to do that. Juan de Cole, Two-Face, Wizkid. There's this guy on Chocolate City now called Dice. But it's just few of them that have that level of talent where they hear the music and they just start singing it. And you know as soon as they start singing that this is a hit.
Well, I think one of the most important things throughout that story, I mean, there are a lot of important things to pull out, but one of the most important things is you being genuine as really a person, because I feel like a lot of people in your position would have been like, well, I think this guy's talented. Let me just have him in my back pocket because I can make some money off of it. But you said is you saw that he was ready and you didn't want to hold him back. And I think that shows sort of a true appreciation for music, but it also shows the sort of character it takes to be a successful person. I mean, what do they say? Dimming someone else's light doesn't make your light shine any brighter. So it's an element of pushing people out there and this sort of communal way of doing business.
Yeah. I mean, you're correct. I think that's something. So sometimes people aren't going to share the same opinion. They're going to be like, hey, you should have signed it. You know, here's the thing. You just have to make choices that you personally can live with. Mm. I've always been a big believer in being like super honest with people about where they, even up till today, a lot of times when people don't sign the Chocolate City is because when we have our first conversation, I'm really honest. You know, I'm like, look, this is how much money I think we can realistically expect to make, you know, and there's sort of the idea of the big pitch. You know, when you sign someone, but you have to be careful because music is people's, it's their lives, it's their art. So they have to have a real, you know, a real understanding of the journey, you know. And so even yesterday I had a meeting with a group of artists who I could tell they were frustrated with some things that were happening. But I will always refer them back to the first conversation we had. And I'll be like, look, I told you guys it's going to be tough. I told you guys are going to get frustrated. And the frustration is good because it's going to be the period in which you innovate, right? And I prefer to work with people where we're on the same page, you know. Even when we disagree, or even if we reach a point where we can't work together going forward, I think that the respect of this person has always been a straight shooter with me from day one. The respect will be there, you know. And to me, that's more important than making the sort of moves that will, you know, get you in trouble, unless you're Suge Knight, of course.
I remember is in 2008 when I started at Calvin, I randomly reached out through Facebook. And I think it's important to note that it's not like you and I had this sort of amazing relationship. I'd spoken to you maybe a handful of times before then, but I reached out on Facebook just because I was curious and I was hearing a lot of your music in the States. And I was asking just random questions. And I remember one thing you said was about how in the road to success, you'll find that people you used to be cool with all of a sudden start acting differently. You lose relationships, and sort of bad relationships come into your life. Can you speak a little bit about that? I mean, because I don't think that's something that's unique to just music. I mean, it probably happens more because the influx of capital is a lot faster, but it's something that people face in every industry as they're working hard, as they're putting their head down. But can you talk a little bit about that and give encouragement to people who are going through similar things?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of times we're not prepared for change, right? And so we always see change. Like when it really happens, we see it as a bad thing, whether it's a relationship, breaking up in a relationship, whether it's people changing around you, whether it's the way your relationship would change with your parents, right? So I'm sort of at the stage now with my parents where we're almost like siblings, right? The kind of conversations we have where I can say, you know, I don't agree with that, whatever. I mean, the respect is still there, but, you know, I can sense every day the dynamics changing. And it may very well come to a point, I hope it doesn't, but where I will be responsible for taking care of my parents and almost like the roles have done a 180, right? And in music, especially, you're going to be introduced to so many people, you're going to see so much change. Everyone around you is going to change because, you know, there's going to be so much like the impetus that's like pushing your career, whatever. There are going to be so many factors pushing at the same time. People are going to see your ego is going to change very quickly. How you have to talk to people. So if you and I had seen in 2008, I'd probably be like, hey, now I may not have as much time, or may not, I'll give an example. I may not want to start. So people walk up to me and every time a young artist walks up to me, they want to have a real conversation. Hey, my music was, and I just don't have the time to anymore. Mm. Right. And I don't want to start the conversation because I know that they're going to get disappointed down the road. So I sort of at the beginning sort of do it like, hey, what do you want? How can I help you? I cannot do that. This is what you need to do for me to help you. You can speak to this person if you want this done, right? And someone standing and watching me would probably be like, yo, he used to be so simple and so easy. But look, the only thing constant is change. I will say one more thing, though, that the maybe hardest part of change is the other side of the transition. It's not even the journey to the top. So when you get to the top of the hill and you start climbing down, there's a lot of change there, too. Right? And I don't think we're prepared at all. I mean, that's something that deeply worries me, not just for myself, but around a lot of, you know, artist friends that I have. But how prepared are we for life after all this excitement and all this, you know, are we going to be prepared to, you know, just go back to life and, you know, because it's constant. You're going to lose friends. You know, you're going to, people aren't going to understand the pressure you're dealing with.
Yeah.
And, I think the one thing I can share with people is to start to learn acceptance, you know, accept what is happening and be okay with your journey in life, you know, having the personal self-confidence to know that your story is as valid and special as the next person. Because if you're caught up in trying to compare someone else's journey with yours, then you're just going to end up in a bad place.
Yeah.
So just accept, hey, people were in my life before and they're not going to be there anymore, and that's fine. But the people that are there, I got to be able to, you know, value them and do right by them so that, you know, I can also find peace and happiness and fulfillment and, you know, sacrifice and giving and sharing and all that good stuff.
Yeah. And so we've gotten to know about your journey, but we want to know a little bit more about you as an entrepreneur. So what fires you up in the morning? What's your morning routine, and why is that routine so important to you?
Yo, my morning routine is actually terrible. I'm actually working on that right now. I think years of being a musician have allowed me to get complacent with my mornings. So I'm literally right now learning from the first time the alarm rings to do the 5-second thing where you just count down and just get up and don't hit snooze. Even though today I hit snooze so I set my alarm for like 7 a.m. and I woke up like 8 something. I just kept hitting snooze. but what fires me up, first part of your question is, you know, it all comes from a place of passion. So I'm passionate about music. I'm passionate about, you know, being part of, you know, an artist journey or whatever. And as long as you're working hard in something you're passionate about, you'll keep learning. And I think one of the greatest motivators for me is the opportunity to apply things that I've learned. So as soon as I figure something out, I'm like, oh, I'm going to need to, you know, practice this and see if it works for me, you know. And it's interesting. It's important that you stay learning, because if you don't stay learning, you're going to think your way is always right. And you're going to have, when you face obstacles, they're going to sap your energy. But if you're trying new things, you're going to say, well, oh, maybe, you know, maybe I'm not right. Maybe this is a better way to do this. And then you'll have new energy to keep trying. So that's something that keeps me going in terms of my routine. And, you know, I'll say that I'm learning a lot. Right. So the skill set that make you successful as an artist are completely different from the skill set that will make you successful as an entrepreneur. And just in business, in terms of learning, I think one of the big challenges for me was to go from a place of being a doer to being a manager, right? And allowing other people to delegate and allow other people to do. Because as an artist, you're doing the interview, you're recording the song, you're doing the video, you're on stage. You're the person doing all the time, and everybody else around you sort of manages. When you become a CEO, what you need is for other people to do things, and you have to receive, you know, give instruction and receive feedback and assess and then give new instructions. Well, what happened is that a lot of times in the process of giving instruction, you say, you know what? Step out of the way. Let me show you how to do this. Right? Let me help you with this concert. Let me help you do this. Let me help you. And that has not been efficient for me. So I'm learning. That's one of the things I'm learning and coping with. I've been saying to people when I got the job, and even now I say to people, you know, ask me more, ask me these questions in a couple more years when I'm done. You know, when I leave being the CEO of music, then I'll answer all these questions. Then I'll have like what I did was, but for now I'm a student and I'm learning and I'm growing. And I love the fact that, you know, I have the opportunity. I mean, I always, whenever I talk to Otto, I always say to him, thank you for the opportunity. Mm. Because it is a great, you know, learning, you know, opportunity.
Mm. And yeah, so much to unpack. One of the things I'm fascinated by is that step from becoming an artist or an entrepreneur and becoming a manager or an executive. Just a very brief overview. What were some of the toughest things about that transition for you?
You know, I think my story has some specific things. So a big piece of it was that when I started, I told Iceprint, I said, hey, I'm not going to do this without you. And a year into the process, Iceprint said, you know, I actually want to go do my own thing. And that was very painful personally for me. At the same time, because the media were really like coming for me.
Mm.
And, you know, something was transitioning. So I sort of took a lot of the blame for a lot of the transition. And when Iceprint left, it was sort of like, well, you see, even Iceprint is leaving. Even Iceprint is jumping ship.
Mm.
You know, so I think those are things that were specific to my story. But, as far as just generally, if I was something general to say is that, you know, if you have a spirit and, a spirit that's open to learning, I think it'll be much easier. If you try to apply the things you know and be stubborn with the things you know, then you're going to completely shut off, you know, so much room for learning and room for improvement. Also, another important thing is being able to understand feedback and data when you get it back, even when you fail, even when it's perceived that you fail, not wasting a lot of time on negative energy or being sad or being depressed about it, and just understanding that, hey, this is data. You need to process the data and understand what is happening and make changes as soon as possible. You know, and I think as an artist, I was always the sort of artist that would listen to people in the studio and say, hey, okay, why don't you like this song? Why don't you think this beat works?
Mm.
So I took that from being a musician and applied it. And being able to say, hey, this is what I really believe this, and it didn't work, and I need to understand why you guys think it didn't work. A lot of times it's about ownership. You know, if people don't have ownership, the project is not going to work.
Mm.
You know? And so that's a big thing that I learned. But yeah, man, it's still learning out here, man.
Yeah.
I have all the answers. I'm reading a lot every day. I'm YouTubing a lot, actually. Like the other day I was in Nairobi and I was meeting with people, you know, people that I thought, you know, might be able to help us at CCK. And the little things like just pulling up a YouTube video of, you know, things to look for when you hire, right? And you sort of have your personal, you know, gut feeling, and you have your questions that you put on, and you just hear from another entrepreneur's point of view what are things they look for, and sort of, you know, synthesize it with what, you know, your thoughts are, and it'll help. So it's a great time though, because there's so much information out there.
Mm, mm-hmm. And so as I'm sure, as a musician, as an entrepreneur, passion, you've already mentioned passion several times in this interview. It really drives what you do. But can you take us to a moment where that passion almost didn't seem enough to sustain you through a dark period? We want to know a specific time where it was difficult for you.
Oh, yeah, man. So, I mean, this is 1 year into being CEO, right? So basically this article that came out was, it says, reviewing MI's first 6 months as CEO. And the guy goes, MI's holding, you should check it out. Maybe you could check it out on YouTube. And he says, well, this album was supposed to come out. MI hasn't done it. This, Jesse Jackson said he has 3 albums. This is 6 months. You know what I mean? I think, you know, and with the presidency in different countries, they do the first 100 days.
Yeah.
You know, but they're sort of steps in terms of what you're supposed to do, set up a cabinet, set up, you know, those sort of things, and they're visible. But I don't think in business that that's a healthy way you know, especially when someone has been in the office, like Otto was in CEO for 10 years.
Yeah.
Right. But anyway, so they write this article. I'm having trouble with a few artists who are unhappy. One of them wanted to leave. I'm sort of dealing with that at the same time. And then iSpence says, hey, I'm going to go do my own thing. And I think when iSpence was leaving, emotionally, because he was the VP of music at the time, emotionally, he had a lot of artists that were confused as to, you know, and I honestly think he just, there was a time when he just wanted to do his own thing. I don't think it was anything personal, you know, but in terms of how it was interpreted, you know, it was like, well, you know, if even iSpence can leave, you know, the validity here. And then the media just didn't stop, man. They just kept, you know, coming and coming. And here's the thing. I'd have to come in on Monday and be strong in front of the staff. I'd have to have meetings with the artists where I'm personally dealing with all this pressure put up on me. And one day, you know, the board called me in. Aldo and Paul called me in and they were like, hey. And it wasn't like, hey, what's going on? But, you know, I could see at least what I sensed to be, you know, hopefully we did the right thing. You know, it's a very interesting, in my opinion, it was very like divide and conquer, because it's very like, hey, when Aldo was in, you know, when Aldo was CEO, this was happening, but, you know, so we had to have like a real conversation. I was, you know, I had to show strength in terms of saying, I'm the right person. I know what I'm doing, you know, but at the same time, you know, having to live through the vulnerability of questioning, you know, hey, should I even be here? You know, I'm an artist. Should I even be here? Should I even be, what's the win in this for me? You know, obviously I make more money being an artist than being paid as a CEO. So, what's the win in it for me? But, recently I heard something, somebody say, you always overestimate what you accomplish in a year, but underestimate what you accomplish in 10 years. And I can look over the 3 years I've been there and say that that's absolutely true. Every year we say we're going to accomplish 10 and we get 5. But over 3 years, when we thought we were going to get 30, we somehow see that we're at 45. I don't know if that makes sense.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, a lot of great things. You spoke about, that sort of tension, or not necessarily tension, but you said you were like shocked and sad when iSpence decided to leave. How did you handle that? Did you talk to him? Did you just get over it yourself? What was the process of moving through that?
Good question. The conversation with him, so in terms of as a big brother, I understood emotionally where he was going, and he explained the world. So I don't know if I really felt I needed to have a conversation with him about how I felt, because I understood. So that decision did have real time repercussions for you, you know. I guess now I understand it a little better. But at the time, I think I had to do a lot of dealing with it myself. I think
I was in a relationship at the time, and that I would just have conversations, but I couldn't really emote too much because my staff are watching, artists are watching, you know, to see, you know, see how, you know, how I felt about it. It's almost like there's a classic Obama story where he's golfing the weekend that the Marines are going to kill Osama bin Laden. And, you sort of have to just, you know, be calm, and even though you're dying inside or you're in a lot of turmoil within. If you have stability, and you spoke earlier about stability and, you know, being able to take off the job when I get home, I think that then you don't take anything personally, or you don't keep anything personally. So in the moment, it might feel personal, but it doesn't stay in the personal space. You know, it sort of transitions into a place where you get that it's work, and you have to, you know, hey, you know, this is inspiration to do something else and move and pivot and, you know, innovate, etc.
And a at the Knowledge Bandits, we're not going to stay in those down moments. We're going the opposite way. So what is one moment as an artist, as an entrepreneur, where you felt like this is exactly where you needed to be? The stars aligned, the universe ordained this sort of position that you were in. Can you take us to that moment?
So it's, for me, it's actually a little moment. The PR guy, Sosa, now who set this thing up, it's seen him blossom over the last 3 months, where he sent me something today and he's like, oh, we're working on something with CNN and blah, blah, blah. And just seeing him blossom. And you know that, you know, hey, because a lot of our pool of people we're working with are young people that, that come into the music industry not knowing really what they want to do. And so they have to learn on the job. And then there'll be moments, there'll be pockets where they'll all of a sudden they'll figure it out and they'll be excited, you know, and everything will sort of come together in one meeting and you're like, wow, this is exactly why, you know. Or it'll be an artist where they'll have a moment where, you know, all of a sudden people are, you know, the song isn't big yet, you know, but they just have a moment the day after an album drops or a single drops where they're just, you know, that, wow, I'm here, you know. And then every once in a while, somebody in my office will send me a message and say, you know, thank you, inspire me, or, you know, and those things mean everything. Or an artist will say, you know, hey, I appreciate you for what you've done, you know, and it'll be for something small. It's not going to be like an award or like, you know, it'll just be a little moment and it'll be something personal. And those moments for me are the moments that make it worthwhile. As an artist, that's a good question. After a while, the awards and, you know, record sales and stuff, they just become business. But, maybe every once in a while, I'll bump into someone who'll share a story. So I did a show in Kenya, in South Africa, actually, last year. And I was performing one there, and the PR people had me meet a bunch of artists. I mean, what am I saying? Had me meet it was one girl who said she was a fan, and then she came with her sister, and they said, hey, we just lost our mom to cancer. And while she was sick, we would listen to One Naira all the time. And so I went to the person to set it up. So I said hi to them. We hung out, gave them tickets for the show. They were happy. They said they're going to come. I went behind their backs. I went and got pictures of them and their mom. Hung out. When I was performing the song, we just pulled it up. I called them on stage, pulled them up called them on stage. We turned towards the back where there was like visuals, and just, it was a long play of One Naira, and we're singing together, and there's pictures of their mom and the two sisters like hug each other, and there's like this super emotional moment. And that was like, you know, it was everything right. It was organic. It wasn't planned. It wasn't part of the process of me performing on stage, or, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't something I could have anticipated. It was a real moment with people that had a real experience listening to, you know, a song, and made it come alive for me in a new way, you know, because at the bottom of it, One Naira is about loyalty, you know, and so it's about a family that's stuck together, you know, through probably the darkest periods. And to me, that moment is not even about the memory of their mom as much as it was about their loyalty to each other, that we both stood with each other through the toughest thing we've both dealt with. As sisters, and we're still here. And, you know, those sort of moments, and you have one every once in a while, once every 9 months, you have one powerful moment. And it will be, in that moment, you'll know it's worth it, you know?
Yeah. I think I always like to point this out. To everyone listening, it's not really about the money. If you're great at what you do, the money will come. But the most memorable things are the connections that you make with people. And I hear it all the time. Entrepreneurs say, oh, the best moment was probably the first time I was maybe $10,000 in debt. Who knows how much in debt? But it was the first moment that a customer said, oh, I really enjoy your product. Keep doing what you're doing. And those are the sort of moments that you should sort of look for as an entrepreneur, is looking to connect with people. Once you connect with people and you're doing it in a great way, they'll pay for whatever you have.
Absolutely.
As we move on, we're going into the rapid fire round. Are you ready?
I'm ready. I'm not. All right. I'm not prepared, but I'm ready.
Sometimes that's all it takes. All right. So what would you say was initially stopping you from taking the step to become an entrepreneur, an artist?
I think the big thing is waiting for an opportunity, sense of entitlement that a lot of young people have to grow out of, you know, where your parents do everything for you and you're like, hey, who's going to give me the opportunity to, you know, or invest in my ideas? And a lot of times you have to start that journey yourself. Sometimes some people are lucky that someone is there in the right place at the right time, but a lot of times you have to start yourself.
And when did you stop looking at what you were doing as a project and more as an actual business?
Early on for me, because remember I wanted to be the manager, so I was like, hey, I have this little money, I'm gonna invest in these artists. So I was lucky in that way. I guess it's because I never thought, you know, anyone wanted to hear what I had to say as an artist. You know, I never thought I would be the dope artist. So I could play the business role for someone else. But it still is a journey in terms of finding new ways to say, hey, this thing that I do that I don't take serious can actually be monetized. So it's a process that has started early on for me, but has never ended. And I still have to, you know, look around every day and be like, hey, I can monetize this other thing. I can monetize this other thing, you know, and find a way to do it.
Mm. And what is your superpower as an entrepreneur?
Wow. I'm going to say optimism in ideas. When I hear an idea that sounds logically, I am so super optimistic about the fact that it will work. I'm super optimistic, super, super optimistic. I'm like, this has got to work. All we got to do is this. And I'm passionate. I'll push it, you know, all the way. So I guess that would have to be improved.
And what's one quality you wish to improve on most?
Just being able to organize so many things. It's like what they say about economics, using limited resources to satisfy unlimited needs or wants. So using the limited time I have, organizing the limited time I have to be able to manage the unlimited tasks, you know, in front of me, doing a better job at that.
Yeah. And what's one of the best pieces of advice you've received and who is it from?
I once sat with a Beanie Man and I said, you know, hey, do you have any advice for me as a young artist? And he said, you're living it. And that was so profound. I don't think I got it completely in the moment, what he meant. But today I interpret it to mean, as long as you're trying to do something, you are living the advice that you need. You know, as long as you're attempting. You're actually in the moment, you're living the advice you need, you know. So most people, it's just get started, just start doing something, do what you can with what you have where you are, you know. And that will sort of, you know, become, it will create a new reality in the world around you. So maybe that.
Yeah. And what is something reading?
I have another piece of advice. I can't remember who said it, but it was at the Sony Illuminoof Foundation. I was there sitting and someone said, very simple concept. He said, revenue before cost. And growing up in Joss, you know, we used to, you know, we're taught invest in your launch or your product, spend money on the launch and all these things. And I'm learning to say, hey, how is it going to make money first? And then I'll find a way to, as I make money, then I'll spend to improve it, you know, but just start it down to the same concept of start what you're going to do, start making money with it. And then, you know,
Nice. And what is something you're reading currently?
I'm reading a book called Productivity Ninja. It's helping me think about it's a real fun book, and it just deals with how to be more productive, how to, you know, like the chapter I just read is about how to get your email to zero, and keep it at zero. And my email today is at 22 unread mails. I have 22,000 something across four email boxes. So a lot of it is junk mail, but I get, that's part of what he speaks about, how to find out what's important, what you need to deal with now, you know, and how to process, you know, the information.
Let's see, what is one internet resource or application that you couldn't live without? And that's excluding Google and Facebook, some of the main ones.
Wow. Can I say YouTube? I can't say YouTube, right?
That seems a little too mainstream.
Yeah. I mean, but it's mainstream, but it's super effective. You can literally just type in. I mean, sometimes it's about actually using a simple thing in front of you, you know, actually using it. Right. And I'm not a huge techie person. I'm learning to use my calendar better, and that's really helped, you know, help me to be more productive. But I will not try to understate the importance of Google and YouTube. This, it's so elementary and so simple and so profound, but trust me, if you use them properly, they will, that's all you really need, you know. Just getting information, networking, and, you know, being prepared, and, you know.
And you spoke about sort of having MI, the artist, and then Jude, the person. So how do you unwind from a hectic schedule?
So mentally, you just know when you need to know when you are no longer MI, or when you're no longer at the office, and then create time, especially as an artist, right? Because people call me MI even when I'm at home. So it's a job that, you know, never really, you never really stop living and being, but you have to know, hey, I'm at home now and I need to unwind. And you have to know when you're starting to get stressed and take time. And even in the book Productivity Ninja, they're talking about how there's a chapter I just finished reading where he speaks about, you know, managing your, not managing time is important, but managing your attention is more important, right? And knowing that, you know, your attention is a resource. You can have time to do something, but throughout the 8 hours you're at the office, you're probably not attentive throughout all of them. And you have to be able to, you know, have attention for stuff. So knowing when to unplug, knowing when to just play PlayStation, you know, and just relax is as important as knowing how to, you know, set meetings. Because you're going to need to refuel yourself. You're going to need to take a break. You're going to need to, you know, keep that energy, a resource, you know, above zero.
Yeah. Nice. And to close out the rapid fire round, do you feel like you've made it yet?
Absolutely not. One of the biggest things that I figured out early on was that there's a trap as an artist for you to try to live your whole life in 15 years, right? And to be defined by what you did in 15, 20 years as who you are. Like, I'm an artist today, but I'm not an artist. I'm a human being who was an artist and maybe something else, who is an artist, but maybe something else. You know, maybe an entrepreneur. I may be a farmer. I may be, you know, I may go into politics. I may go into other things. I think, you know, young people now need to know that over the course of your life, you're probably going to be required to learn more than one skill and do more than one job in different things, right? So it's already happening, but the knowledge that is actually going to be survival going forward, you know, over the past, specialization has been a big thing, but now it's almost like the new specialization should be on, you know, adaptability, or, you know, your ability to change and ability to learn and unlearn and completely forget something, old way of doing something, and adapt to a new way. So I definitely have not arrived,
and I'm still, this is just the beginning of the journey.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that was a great rapid fire round. Again, just dropping knowledge all the way, all along through the journey. But as we cool down, you mentioned Productivity Ninja. Is there another book that you would like to recommend to the bandits?
Yeah, well, there are a lot of books actually, but I'm going to pick one. There's a book that is, it's sort of a classic by an author called Dale Carnegie. It's called How to Win Friends and Influence People. And it taught me so much about understanding people and what motivates people and how to communicate. And, it's definitely a book that I feel every entrepreneur, every human being should read once in their lives, but as an entrepreneur to have on your desk that you can always come back to. That's a book.
Nice. And you spoke a little bit about mentorship indirectly. You talked about Ice Prince coming up to you and sort of asking you to show him the ropes. So I want to ask, what's the value of mentorship in your eyes, and who are your mentors?
Man, mentorship is so important because even just emotionally, right? So yeah, I mean, they're obviously, you know, sort of skill set and technical aspects, there are obviously benefits that I'm sure everyone listening to the Knowledge Bandits will be able to identify. However, emotionally, one of the things as an entrepreneur, somebody doing, is that you cannot be a full emotional human being all the time at work. You have to be professional. So having a mentor is sometimes having someone that you can go to where you can be weak, you can be vulnerable, you can be afraid. Like, the process I was talking with you about, in terms, I couldn't be weak in front of the board, right? I couldn't be weak in front of my staff. I couldn't be weak in front of the artist, right? So it's having someone where you can go and say, look, I'm afraid, you know, am I screwing up? You know, and I think that there's a lot of value in that. But just generally, who are my mentors? I mean, I've been very lucky. I have a great relationship with my dad and with my pastor. His name is Bola DBC, the guy that started the studio. And, in terms of emotionally, I can turn to them. In terms of in what I'm doing, Adu is, you know, I can just hit Adu up because he went through exactly the same journey as I did. He's a lawyer by training. I became a record label exec and sort of figured it out as he went along, you know. And so he has like real advice for me, you know. And then his partner, Paul, is also a great, great resource for me. He's worked within the corporate setting for a long time. I thought I had a lot of high positions, executive positions in Microsoft and Nokia, in British American Tobacco. And so he's someone that if I'm stuck somewhere or I need a, you know, and think different way about a business model or something, he, you know, I can usually call on him. And then, being part of networks also is very important. Just today, I had a problem. I'm part of something called the Desmond Tutu Fellowship, some leadership fellowship. And I just reach out within the group. I just say, hey guys, I'm looking for a way to do this. And I tell you, it's something that has to do with the presidency. I got numbers in seconds. You know, but like, oh, you should speak to this person. You should speak to that person. And, you know, part of a network also helps.
Nice. And sort of in this same vein of a mentorship, I'm going to ask for you to mentor some of our listeners. So for those people that are listening who are maybe afraid to take that next step, they know they should, what advice can you give them?
Fear is important if you use it right. Fear is like your body's natural, you know, survival. The most important thing, you know, that I think the body does for us is to make us alert that there's danger around. And so, but if you just stay in a position of being afraid, even the body, you know, after a while it will release adrenaline, it will make your senses heightened, but after a while it will cool down and it will allow you to assess properly, right? And that's why we have memory, and one of the things that you have to do is to be able to properly analyze
what you're dealing with, why you're afraid, what the challenges are, because staying in a position of fear is staying in the position where you're most vulnerable to danger, right? Meaning that you don't move. It's meaning that you haven't, you know, you haven't equipped yourself, you know, to deal with danger when it comes around. That's not a place for one to remain in. It's an important phase. Don't be alarmed. It's very important. It's the body, it's your mind telling you, hey, there's danger around. You need to be careful. But it's not a state to remain in. You know, it's important that you quickly analyze and you move from there. You know? And and fear for the most part is irrational. You know, it's an irrational response to something. So you want to operate within the realm of the rational, you know, where growth and entrepreneurship and all these amazing things happen. So if you remain afraid, then you become, you know, docile and you become susceptible more to danger. The very thing that you're afraid of will then harm you more if you remain in a state of being afraid.
Yeah.
Analyze and pivot quickly.
And what is one piece of advice you would give to musicians across Africa? And I say Africa because you've had a very eclectic experience as a musician. You travel to different countries. What is one recommendation or one piece of advice you would give to people who are trying to get into the music industry, whether it's to be a musician, whether it's to be an executive, to be an innovator in that space? What advice can you give them?
I'll say, first of all, find a network of people that inspire you, because it's tough on the continent. It's tough to be an artist. It's quite tough. But if you find a network of people that inspire you, it'll make it easier. If you're a singer, for instance, if you have a network of producers that you're working with that, you know, that make it easier for you to record without spending lots of money. The second thing is back to what I said before, revenue before cost. You know, hey, I don't want to borrow all this money and shoot a video, right? Why don't I start doing shows and then raise money that way? You know, so as I do shows, I build my fan base, I work on my performance so that by the time I have a video, then it's easier for me to promote the video, you know, because I already have a fan base through performing. So revenue before cost. Always know how you're going to make money before you spend money. You know? Always have a plan for how much money you want to make. Or better still, start to make money before you spend money.
Yeah. Nice. And unfortunately, we've reached that point where we have to say goodbye. I mean, I could keep going forever. I'm sure you're busy. You have things to do. But can you please let us know how we can connect with you, whether it's through a website, email, Twitter, Instagram, all the social media?
Yeah, man. I'll give out my social media now because it's the easiest way. So I'm MI_Abaga on Twitter and Instagram. On Facebook, I'm MI Abaga. That's ABAGA. And the MI is just MI. You guys, everyone listening, please just follow me on everything. Send me a DM or a message or whatever, and just use the hashtag Knowledge Bandit so I can, if you have questions or whatever. And yeah, man, and thank you, bro, for having me on.
Good luck
with everything you're doing. This is super dope.
Yeah,
I'm glad we make it work.
Yeah.
And by the way, I'll just say one more thing. So when they hit me up to do it today, he had said the time, and I said, no, I don't think that's going to be possible because it'd be like 5 a.m. Right? And he hit me up today to say that you said, no, 5 a.m. is perfect because before you get to your day. And that already lets me know, you know, or gives me a little bit of a glimpse into the kind of person you are. So, you know, I see big things for you, man, in the future.
Thank you. Thank you. And well, we're not letting you off the hook just yet. We always ask for one more parting piece of wisdom before we say goodbye. Yeah.
Man, in the infinite words of Phil Knight and the Nike Corporation, just do it.
Nice. Well, M.I. Jude, it's been amazing having you on today. I've appreciated, I've learned so much from you, and I'm sure the Bandits appreciate it as well.
Yeah, thanks so much, guys.
Yeah.
And yeah, man, please, I'm going to subscribe right now. I'm ashamed to say that I had it up till now. I'm in the podcast, but I'm going to subscribe, and whatever I can do to help, any questions or whatever, maybe they could come through you to me or whatever. Whatever you can do to help.
Nice. Awesome. Well, stay inspired.
Hey, if you're still there, thanks for listening. If you like the show, please hit that subscribe button wherever you listen to podcasts and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Handle is Knowledge Bandits everywhere. We have closed sessions lined up with some of the entrepreneurs that we've already interviewed. So if you have questions that weren't answered during the show, you'll have a chance to connect with them during these closed sessions. Just go to the Knowledge Bandits website at knowledgebandits.com and sign up for the newsletter on the contact page. If you or someone you know has a business, we'd love to share your story with the Knowledge Bandits community. Just send an email to interview@knowledgebandits.com. If you have a question for me or you want to connect with any of the guests so far, send an email to me personally at arum@knowledgebandits.com. Finally, if you love music and you have a few moments, please listen to this song, Mr. Biggs by Dice Ailes.
Everybody, Mr. Biggs. Ooh, Swiss. Dicey, Lele. Yeah, yeah. Everybody, Mr. Biggs. Everybody, Swiss station. Everybody, petrol station. I give you tomato plantation. What you go, guys, they come down, baby. You guys come down, baby. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You guys come down, baby. You guys come down, baby. Yeah, yeah. I day over.
Kill our tools.